The problem here is Capitol Hill, the swamp, the two houses that are too far apart. I mean, the Lord and the Founding Fathers created executive orders because of partisan bickering and divided government. That's what we have here. But the president's taking action. His constituency, let's be clear, his constituency is mainstream Republicans, blue-collar Democrats, and independents who are sick and tired of the swamp. And he reached out and he took action. He, you know, he didn't have to sign those executive orders. He could have just let this keep going. But he did not do that. He took action.
That was White House Director of Trade and Manufacturing Policy and amateur theologian Peter Navarro talking on Meet the Press over the weekend about President Donald Trump's executive orders and memoranda, extending federal relief to Americans in the wake of the coronavirus. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by the full varsity roster of Roundtable-listas, Nicole Espy, Peter Suderman, and a triumphantly eternal Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Let's get right into it. Peter, the president said this weekend whilst signing these things, following, quote, vis-a-vis the ongoing congressional COVID relief negotiations on Capitol Hill, which you have been debriefing us about every week. He said that his executive action will, quote, take care of pretty much this entire situation, unquote. So walk us through what these orders will and will not concretely take care of.
Like Peter Navarro said, this is action, 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 and action. So there's four of them. It's a four piece. Right? It's like Nirvana when Pat Smear was playing guitar.
Action packed.
Right?
Action.
It's like Crosby, yeah. Stills, Nash and Young. Technically a four piece, maybe not for long. Each of the individual
Anderson,
parts.
Anderson, Brookman, Wakeman, and Howe.
Right. They've all got their own separate issues. So the first one is the memorandum on continued student loan payment relief during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's pretty much what it sounds like. It says, hey, Betsy DeVos, she's going to marry Jerry Kasich, to take continued steps to make sure that people don't have to pay their student loans, provided that they are federally serviced. So this will not apply to private loans. This is going to create some issues because it conflicts with the CARES Act, which, for example, required the Department of Education to send out notices that the suspension of payments for student loans was going to end at the end of September. And the Education Department has already been planning to do that. Well, now this is bumping that down the road to the end of the year, but it's doing it through a completely different mechanism, which is a presidential memorandum rather than a congressional order. The next one is the executive order on fighting the spread of COVID-19 by providing assistance to renters and homeowners. So this one tells the Secretary of Housing, Urban Development, right, the Housing Secretary and HHS to consider, and this is important, to consider limiting both evictions and foreclosures through the end of the year. So does that mean that evictions and foreclosures are actually going to be stopped? Who would this apply to? The federal government certainly has a lot of influence in the housing market. There's a lot of federal money involved in housing, and it might be able to do something in buildings, in homes where the federal government has money involved. But it's not really clear exactly what and how that would work. The next one, the third one here, so in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, I think we're on Nash now, is the memorandum on deferring payroll tax obligations, again, in light of the ongoing COVID-19 disaster. So this is being pitched as getting rid of the payroll tax through the end of the year. That's kind of what it is, but not really, because Trump isn't actually saying you don't have to pay the payroll tax through the end of the year permanently. He's saying your employer doesn't necessarily have to collect it from you at the end of the year, but under this order, you would still owe it afterwards unless Congress, or maybe President Trump, if he wins a second term, goes ahead and says, actually, you don't have to pay it at all. Now, this is going to be like a thing between Trump and Biden, where Trump's going to say, well, I deferred it. And if you elect me president, you know, I'm going to say we're getting rid of that payroll tax completely. This also, you know, complicates things for Social Security and Medicare, because that's what our payroll taxes fund. Those programs already don't have enough money. They're already on track for insolvency in the trust funds that don't exist. And this is going to create further problems with that. And it's like, again, you know, these things are written in such a bizarre and sort of obscure way. The Secretary of Treasury shall explore avenues, including legislation, to eliminate the obligation to pay taxes deferred pursuant to the implementation of this memorandum. Right. Like, shall explore avenues. Like,
if you put
George
the
R.
word
R. Martin,
it seems
right?
very civilized.
If you put
it's very
shall,
civilized.
Then it becomes like an yes. official real thing. That's how the word shall
yes.
works.
Explore avenues. George R. Martin, right? He has been exploring avenues for writing the next Game of Thrones book for how long now? And it hasn't happened. It's again, these things, it's not really clear how it all works. It's very sort of hand wavy, even in the writing of these official memorandums. The last one is the memorandum on authorizing the Other Needs Assistance Program for major disaster declarations related to coronavirus disease 2019. That one is the one that, if you just read the title, you might not know what it is doing. That is the one where Trump is unilaterally extending the federal boost in unemployment insurance, which up until the end of July was $600 per week, paid for by the federal government. That expired at the end of July, and now he's extending it to the tune of $400 a week. But to give you an idea of how weird this is, he is doing it through FEMA.
What?
Like the organization that, you know, provides trailer homes and stuff like that for people who, like,
had concentration camps, I think is the
yes,
word you're looking for,
camps
Peter.
For people who have been hurt by, like, lost their homes in hurricanes. So this is being done through FEMA, except that only $300 of that $400 is being done through FEMA, and states are supposed to do the rest. But states, in order to get this boost for their constituents, state governors have to request this money from Washington. And then they're supposed to be able to, like, supposedly the CARES Act, there's a bunch of money left over in state budgets that they're going to use to fund their $100 portion here, except that states are just massively, massively hurting for revenue for obvious reasons, because the economy shut down for most of April and is still hurting a lot, even as it has come back to some extent. And so the idea that states are going to start up separate programs from their existing unemployment insurance programs, fund them using state budgets that are incredibly strapped, and that is going to be the mechanism for making this happen, even if these actions are technically constitutional. Just from a practical perspective, they're going to be unworkable. No one knows how this stuff is going to go. And in some sense, I suspect that the way it's going to go is that it's not going to happen at all. And instead, this is just Trump's way of trying to push House Democrats and Senate Republicans into negotiating further and actually passing a bill. And in fact, Trump has said basically as much.
Catherine, Peter gave us an excellent rundown of the what. So why don't you talk us a little bit, now that you've come off the Appalachian Trail, through the how. Congressman Justin Amash, your ex-boyfriend and the lame duck libertarian, tweeted over the weekend, still waiting on constitutional conservative and liberty-loving, did you hear my air quotes, groups to slam President Trump for executive overreach. I have a feeling I'll be waiting for a while. End quote.
Wow.
As the editrix of a
wow
liberty-loving organization who does not at all drink on Monday mornings. We don't. Is this indeed a slammable executive overreach?
Ooh, baby. Yes, it is. I would like to do some slamming. I thought you were going to say, Peter is doing the what, and Catherine, would you like to do the what the fuck? Because that's frankly where I am right now. I went away for two weeks, to take care of a beautiful, tiny baby, my new nephew. I was not, in fact, on the Appalachian Trail, as absolutely everyone who knows me should have been confident. Mm-hmm. I was neither there nor with my Argentine mistress, but instead snuggling a baby. It was amazing. I come back to this nonsense. I was my loins were girded for nonsense, but this is too much. Obviously, these things cannot be done by executive order. Some tiny fragments of some of these things perhaps can be done by executive order, still shouldn't be in almost every case. My favorite tweets, in addition to the Amash salt, which I am, of course, always here for, salty Amash, but the people who are doing the tweets that are like, can you imagine if Obama had done executive overreach, how mad people would be? And it's like, yes. I can imagine that, too. I remember that thing happening. But I will say, I am not in a super whataboutist mood at the moment. Yes, previous presidents of both parties have dabbled in executive overreach, specifically via the mechanism of the executive order, specifically mostly, I would say, with regard to immigration, although certainly other issues as well. But this really takes the cake. Last night, right before I went to sleep, my final thought, and this shows you the dark places that my mind is in, is, you know who probably wants Joe Biden to win the most for purely profins, even if he actually hates him, is John Roberts. John Roberts is like, I cannot believe that I got on the Supreme Court and now my job is to do stuff like say, no, Mr. President, I'm sorry, you can't ban evictions. And also, he's really mad that he's going to have to decide the election, neither of which are jobs that anyone wants. So,
well, then he should have gotten a good degree from college and had an honest profession.
True.
Yeah. Fair enough. He's reaping
what
he said.
You know what pays really well is being a plumber. He could have been a plumber. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess
Mike Rowe has tens of thousands of jobs that John Roberts could transition into.
Correct.
All of them welding. Every single one.
Every single one is welding or plumbing. So yeah, those are my thoughts. It's basically that this is just such a sign of how wildly out of whack we have gotten from our understanding of normal procedure. And while I get it that the whole world is wildly out of whack, that is no excuse for this behavior, Donald Trump.
Nick,
Yes, Matt, I was busy. I was busy over the weekend celebrating the ascent of Gerald R. Ford to the White House. Some whatever it was, 45 years ago.
Thank God, our
that was the last good time for America. You know, where we really had somebody that deserved to be in the office and that we could really rally around as a national hero.
It also ended our long
national nightmare. Yes, that's right.
Happy.
Which he helped create by being on the Warren Commission and playing for a bunch of losing Michigan football
teams. Wow. A shout out, speaking of Grand Rapids, to the Gerald R. Ford Museum there, which is a real crackerjack place that I...
Yeah, which is in the men's room of a Starbucks.
Untrue.
I mean, it's the smallest presidential library.
Lovely...
I mean, James Buchanan's Willow Wall or whatever it is. It's like... is spacious.
It's a nice
to that.
Place. I know you want to spit bile in whatever directions, but I have a memory of a couple of your policy positions in the past, and please correct me if they're wrong, but if they're right, I'd be curious to get your sense of this. One is that I remember that you saying in the past, this is perhaps years ago, but during budgetary debates, something along the lines of we should be taxed at the level that the government spends, just to be honest about what the bargain is here, but also not to incur just the massive amounts of debt that we are incurring. But I also recall you saying in the past that you're okay with occasionally suspending or permanently suspending payroll taxes, even though those payroll taxes are kind of the pay-as-you-go for our old age entitlements. Am I remembering that correctly? And if so, do you care to explore that contradiction in light of Trump noodling or monkeying around or proposing to payroll taxes and that being a thing that happens during great economic catastrophes from presidents?
Well, one of, I think, this set of executive orders and everything will be remembered for. It's the beginning of the return of debt ceiling discussions when the Republicans lose all houses of Congress, both houses of Congress, the White House and the post office come November. You know that they're going to start talking about, the debt ceiling's a big issue again. Only libertarians have cared about the debt ceiling. Only libertarians have cared about actually paying for the government that we have. My interest in that is partly it's, just basic reality, but it's also true that, well, you know, I talk about government by Groupon. We are getting a 30 to 35% cut on the amount of government that we're paying for. So, of course, we order more because we think we're getting it, you know, we're getting a bargain, which I guess in a way we are. The raising the price of government to approximate the cost of government, I think would not only, it would make us have a real good, serious conversation about, yeah, you know what, maybe we don't need the luxury floor mats and the cargo netting in the back of the new car because it's a little too rich and we're not really going to benefit from that. Having said that, payroll taxes, I'm against payroll taxes because FICA taxes are not actually used to do what they're supposed to do. There is no lockbox, as Al Gore once, I don't know if any, I assume you remember the lockbox fuzzy math debate.
Lockbox is like my earliest political memory, just for the record. That's like... That's a formational.
Yeah. It's your Kennedy assassination. Kennedy assassination. Yeah. Yeah. No. And it's like, you know, but if there was a dedicated stream, you know, of, you know, trust funds that were not immediately loaned out against other things, I think that would be a great thing. Payroll taxes are regressive. Payroll taxes are bad. And by the way, just because this doesn't end if and when Trump gets canned, because payroll taxes are going to grow by about 400% if Joe Biden gets elected, because he's just going to expand the amount of money that and the amount of wages that is subject to Social Security tax. So, yeah, I don't know where that gets us, Matt. I wanted to say, though, very quickly, shame on Chuck Todd for having Peter Navarro on. I watched for the first time in a couple of weeks, I watched some Sunday morning shows. Chris Wallace had on people who were either expert or, you know, political spokespeople, but he grills them and he gets something out of them that is different. The Fox show with Chris Wallace is the only Sunday morning show that is worth watching on the major networks. You know, we just see this kabuki theater. Peter Navarro is terrible. He is a hack's hack. And to have him on television is absurd. It's just, it's a waste of everybody's time. And, you know, that's on display in the quote or the clip that you were running at the beginning of this. We learn nothing from that other than that word. There's a wall of
there's bullshit. I'll put myself in partial agreement with that observation. And it's kind of how and why I've actually totally pulled the plug on watching all cable news over the last 3 months. Not even like the lunchtime, you know, preparation mini cable news is so much of it is, and like there's a pandemic afoot. Like there's some information that would be useful for me to know, and to sort through. But it's this exercise of let's get someone from the administration, or let's just talk about this clip of Trump saying something ridiculous. And it's the president. If he says something ridiculous, that's worthy of discussion to be sure. But also like, let's have scoldy hour. Like, can you believe that they did or said this? And everyone has the sense of like relief that instead of grappling with the difficulty of policy, which it's a difficult thing to go through policy wise, it's just scoldy shake your damn head hour one way or the other. And it like gives me no added knowledge about a damn thing. All right. That's enough rant. Peter.
If I may, in terms of policy, it's not necessarily a bad, I mean, you know, this is all, it's a problem because we have, you know, a bazillion dollars or $25 trillion 26. In debt and growing and all of that. But it is not necessarily a bad thing to defer something like a payroll tax. If you could do it, if you could switch it off and, you know, for a short term, it's kind of like flattening the curve of economic catastrophe. It would immediately put more money into people who are working, into their pockets. You know, that's not a bad thing, but we are so far beyond the realm of having sane, you know, kind of fiscal and even monetary policy debates, because none of it can have any reality because we've been, you know, screwing the pooch for, you know, at least since the 40s.
The Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and other Democrats are criticizing Trump for cutting payroll taxes, which is, again, it's not actually a cut. It's just a deferment as it.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying, like, you know, you get a cash advance.
Even while they praised Obama for doing the exact same thing, because Obama did the same thing in his stimulus bill, or as part of his stimulus package. And I believe George W. Bush also did some sort of payroll tax reduction or cut as part of the stimulus while he was president. This is something that every president does, and you can say it's dumb or not, but it's sort of telling that that's where our political discussion is. The other sort of point of political argument that I just think is worth pointing out is that Pelosi is accusing Trump of, quote, cutting families' unemployment benefits, because the CARES Act that had been passed, you know, in March or April had a $600 a week federal boost. And President Trump's plan, if it goes through and actually works, and like I said, there are a bunch of practical issues, but if it actually worked, would provide $400 a week in additional payments beyond your typical state unemployment insurance benefit. So President Trump is raising the state unemployment benefit, the typical benefit, by $400 a week, and is being accused of cutting it.
Catherine, you were going to say something before the person who's supposed to work for you cut you off without listening to you. Do you care to say, finish your thought?
Totally. I don't know. Ironically, I was actually going to stick up a little bit for having Navarro do the talking head, because I do think hearing someone say out loud, the Lord and the founding fathers made the executive order for a reason, it's good to know that's what's going on. It's good to know that that is a line of thinking that is happening in some kind of inner circle that the president is influenced by and has influenced. And I think right now, one of the biggest questions is the what is going on question. It's like, what is the thinking? What is happening? And so I actually do think, in the spirit of gaining information, that this is information to have people like that on the television saying what they really think and believe out loud for the American people to hear and decide. And that, frankly, a little bit of extra serious policy debate on those TV channels really isn't necessarily going to move the needle. Like, I love me some serious policy debate. That's what we do here at Reason basically all day long. But I don't know that Chuck Todd leading people into the weeds of exactly how to implement a payroll tax cut is necessarily better for the Republic than just knowing what the heck is going on in Peter Navarro's head, and by extension, the heads of those who listen to him and share his views.
To back up that statement, Catherine, I found what was most revealing, not the God and Founding Fathers eye roll producing stuff, but actually, you know, that the action is aimed at, you know, these types of Democrats, these types of independents, and these types of whatever, like this expressly transactional politics being part of the approach of a senior White House and influential White House economic advisor is, to me, worth knowing. Let's shift a little bit and go to a pop quiz, which is kind of a rhetorical one, I guess, because I don't actually want people to answer. But what traditionally gigantic political events are taking place this month, even though you haven't thought about them for even a half a second, and you will not watch any of them. I'm saying you to the listener world, not the poor saps who actually have to pay attention to politics. The answer to this, of course, are the Democratic and Republican national conventions, which I think are both happening this month. I've been going to these since 2000, and I could barely tell you anything about them right now. I use that just as an example of getting our way into a conversation that's a little bit 3 a.m. dorm room-ish, admittedly, but it's kind of about the way that the coronavirus, the pandemic, the response, the massive kind of WTF-ery of our lives has overwhelmed everything else in such a way that we might not really be able to process it, or it's crowding out traditional concerns. I'll give a quick example before, like, asking everyone to noodle on this.
By the way, Matt, I think Kevin Hart is going to be hosting the Democratic National Convention.
That,
like,
would be
so
awesome.
Like, you joke, but also probably.
Well, probably not. I mean, he would have to do some kind of act of forgiveness.
He's been uncanceled. Those tweets are now, you know, they're part of the history.
But he's going to do it on Instagram Live, right? I mean, or on TikTok.
100%.
Yeah. No, that's what the Democratic convention is going to be on TikTok. And the Republican convention is going to be
Republican
on
a real
American company.
On Parler.
That means Neil Ferguson has to do the Republican convention. My quick example of what I'm talking about is that on Friday, the New York Post gave the first leaked round of survey results among New York City parents who have kids in the public school system. We are all asked, and I have two daughters.
Wait, are we not going to talk about the conventions?
Not we can. You can talk about them if you want.
No, I was just going to say, I actually, what I'm looking forward to is they're going to be covered by Twitch. And I'm really hoping that, you know, them and a bunch of ESPN commentators now, I mean, it will be better for them to be fully live streamed, I think. Fewer people will watch, but there'll be more information out there.
Are you going to be able to enjoy the Twitch coverage now that Dr. Disrespect is no longer on Twitch and had to move to YouTube for completely mysterious reasons?
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, that I'm looking forward to. I think it's going to be like the OJ trial was in the 90s. It's going to birth a whole new roster of commentators.
I do think Twitch is the right place to put this sort of coverage in 2020, not just because the whole thing has been blown up and gone crazy. And I'm sorry, Matt, but because Twitch is where the new generation of crazy, like, broadcast personalities are honing their talent. And there are all of these dudes, mostly, some, I mean, you know, who are just playing video games and talking a lot of shit in a lot of cases, but just playing video games and talking for hours and hours and hours and getting huge audiences for it. And it actually seems like if you want to sort of identify the place where the next, you know, Rush Limbaugh is going to come from, it's going to be Twitch or something like it. And a lot of them are getting increasingly political, and there's all of this weird stuff.
I'm hoping Jenna Marbles will commentate
a
blackface.
I'm just saying, Peter Suderman getting really excited about people talking for hours and hours and playing video games is the most on-brand thing I've ever heard in my darn life.
Over the RNC. Yeah. You know, when Scott Baio is saying the Pledge of Allegiance and things like that, it's going to be pretty exciting.
I just want to know who's going to be
the Dixie Chicks. What are the Dixie Chicks called now?
They're just chicks.
They should be called the Dicks.
I refuse to use that name.
No. Yeah. No.
D-I-X. Okay. D-I-X. D-I-X.
The Dicks. Dicks. That's not bad.
No.
Yeah.
We got to rescue this segment. I just want to know who the Roger Cossack is going to be of 2020.
You just did the opposite.
We'll know in another 20
Matt.
Years.
You're like,
Matt,
let me rescue this segment, and then you lit it on fire and threw it in a garbage can.
I said we gotta, not that I'm gonna.
You're the host,
which is different.
We gotta get out of this place.
You have reason, as they say, Catherine. Mm. What is a way in which the enormity of the coronavirus bigger than our ability to process it, and what kind of impacts you think that might have? I was going to give an example, but there's no way that it'll go uninterrupted. So why don't you begin, since you've been
It's about the New York City schools.
My example is buying things, the way that people are buying things. The sort of inciting thought for this is the extremely excellent New York Times Magazine cover story from this weekend, which was called Sweatpants Forever. How the fashion
such a good story.
How the fashion industry collapsed. And it's a wonderful piece. I mean, really, you could care 0% about the fashion industry. You could truly have been sweatpants always and still get a lot out of this piece. But it got me thinking in general about the fact that the way that people consume stuff is so radically altered right now. And all these industries are collapsing around themselves that are not even the obvious ones. I mean, of course, you know, restaurants are closed. Of course, bars are closed. But this piece, for instance, details that there used to be kind of five separate runway shows spread across three or four different seasons that were actually a year out of sync, and that the whole timeline and cycle of how new fashion moved through top-end retailers has just completely imploded. It's just completely dead. It's done. It's over. Now, it was basically rotten on the inside already, is the thesis of this piece. And there are a lot of industries that were rotten on the inside already, arguably public schools as well. So maybe we can get back to your example. But I am struck by the fact that I am spending way less money since March than I used to. When I approve Reason expense reports, which, like, someday we should just do a segment on the what's in those. But when I approve Reason expense reports, they are tiny compared to what they used to be. And we were not a Living High on the Hog magazine before, but just to do your normal life and normal business is expensive. And now there's nothing to spend money on in the same way. And I think that is really, even if there's a vaccine tomorrow and everything reopens, people are not going to go back to consuming the way they consumed, up to and including, like, I don't know. I don't think a lot of ladies out there are buying high heel shoes.
Do you think people
again.
Are more spiritual?
I think we're done.
Are people more
Absolutely
spiritual
not.
Now?
I think people are consumerist in the their souls and always will be, but I think the stuff they consume is going to be different, and that's going to be really interesting.
Fact check, you don't believe in souls.
Ugh, you got me there, Suderman.
I just can't believe she doesn't believe in high-heeled shoes. I mean, what kind of devilry is that? Suderman, what are some ways in which you think things are bigger than we can deal with, and what does that mean?
Even before you brought this up, I was thinking about this kind of general like gaseous ball of topic, right? Like the biggest change in my life in the last 6 months, and probably the biggest change in since I graduated from college and moved to Washington, D.C. and started sort of my professional adult life, has been in the last 6 months where I no longer can make plans. I just can't make plans for 6 months or 12 months or 6 weeks or even next week necessarily, because even if you think something is going to happen, it might well be canceled, because it's just so hard to figure out what the state of the world is going to be. And, you know, I like Catherine talked about expense reports, right? Like, there's no, a lot of that is travel. Nobody's, there's essentially no business travel anymore, right? There's no sort of business meetups, right? Like, my schedule used to be pretty packed. I was out 4 or 5 nights a week for some sort of social, professional, or quasi-professional, quasi-social event pretty regularly.
DC
and
is bad,
I
y'all.
Don't have
left out alcoholic.
Any of those things. Yes, there was often drinking involved, but all of this would, right? Like, and I can't, I would regularly see a movie screening just about every week. There has not been a movie screening in Washington, D.C. since the middle of March. There have not been any movies. This is the longest I have gone without seeing a movie in a theater, probably certainly since I was in high school, possibly since I was in middle school. And it's just very strange to not know when that's going to resume and not know. Even if movies come back, are they going to come back to Washington, D.C.? So Tenet, the big blockbuster that is supposed to reopen theaters in the United States, has been scheduled for an end of August release internationally. And then a little while after that, they are planning to release it in select cities in the United States. Which select cities? We don't know. How many? We don't know. Is Washington, D.C. going to be one of them? How are they going to do screenings for critics? Are they going to do screenings for critics? No idea. This thing has been pushed back and pushed back. And that just sort of seems like the state of everything, but especially sort of professional kind of work-related events, conventions, sort of anything where you gather with other people in the same room. We don't know when that's coming back. And it's very strange just to sort of look at a Google calendar that is completely empty after years and years and years of seeing them increasingly full.
Spoken like a non-parent, Suderman. No, everyone who has, and this kid's in college too, right? Anyone who has kids doesn't know what's gonna, their kids are gonna be doing with their days come September. There's almost no exception to that. Well, I guess quite a few people know that schools won't be open and know that it's going to suck, but like otherwise don't know how they're going to deal with it, how you're going to try to work with brats running around or whatever, like what kind of pods you're going to get. It's going to be, it's that uncertainty is is amazing and literally maddening. Like, it makes you more mad because like you're more irritable. And that's not me talking. Like, I'm much better than I was in the spring. That's for damn sure.
Matt, in the spring, we should talk about this since, again, going back to the conventions, we started having convention planning meetings in like December of last year.
I know.
I'm looking at your face right now. And I don't want to bring back all the, I don't want to make the maddening even more, but I had this year planned out, all of the things that were going to happen and all of the things that I was going to do and many of the things I was going to write about. And absolutely none of those things are happening. And I don't know what's going to happen instead. And it's just like, now I just like wake up each day and I'm like, well, I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do today. And maybe I'll think about what I'm going to eat for dinner, you know, at noon or something. But that's about as far ahead as I plan at this point, because all of the plans that I made just collapsed.
Peter, are you going to try to expense Mulan on Disney Plus?
I don't know, Catherine. Am I going to try to expense Mulan on Disney Plus?
I mean, it seems like it would be pretty easy to create a scenario in which you could justify that. Yes.
Nick, I was motivated to do this segment as amorphous as it is by actually your Instagram picture, which I found very kind of sad and haunting on some level, which is of a great Debbie Harry mural in Manhattan.
It's actually Blondie the band.
Thank you for the fact check live.
It's not important. Debbie Harry.
The internet allows us to fact check your ass.
Yes, that's right.
And this mural has been defaced by graffiti, as has a whole hell of a lot of even good neighborhoods like where I live. Can you talk a little bit about how just sort of the enormity of the change, or maybe you don't feel it as the enormity of a change, but I have the suspicion that at least like your neighborhood and your sense of things, like things seem to be slipping or morphing in ways that are kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah. And, you know, to pick up on what both Peter and Catherine have been talking about, I think for me, it's almost as if a lot of things, a lot of just cultural institutions, political institutions, economic institutions like retail were rotting out anyway. And the pandemic has kind of pushed that all over the edge or accelerated a little bit, just like Trump. I still hold by what a lot of us were talking about in 2015, 2016. Trump is not the cause of this stuff, but he is the result of the rotting out of so many political institutions and whatnot, and an accelerant. And I think the pandemic has been in the best way possible. Hopefully it will be an accelerant that just pushes over old institutions that are worn out. I mean, people have been talking about the end of shopping malls. Matt, you and I grew up in kind of the golden age of the indoor shopping mall, you know, starting in the early 70s. That technology, that retail technology is dead or is dying. It never will go away. It's like radio didn't go away because of TV, but it got supplanted in a kind of hegemonic way. I think we're just seeing a speeding up of a lot of that. And I think with New York, for me, I'm thinking about New York City. I came here because what's great about New York is the kind of possibility of social interaction with the types of people you want to be involved with, whether it's in music or arts or politics or policy or business and finance. There's no question that New York has been robbed of that because of the pandemic and because of quarantine and because of people deciding not to go out or to leave the city. But as I was preparing for this, Matt, and I know you study this stuff too, New York from 2017, 2018, 2019, each year lost population. And now it's going to lose more. And so that I think it's helpful to see the pandemic almost as something that was conjured up by an ongoing decline or disruption and petering out of old forms. And that the real question, you know, a lot of this stuff has gone away, but we are consumerists at heart, I think, as Catherine said. So we're going to start spending money and or time on other stuff. And that's really, it's kind of an interesting moment to look at, you know, it in the kind of mushy runes. It's not smoldering runes. It's not 9/11, but it's kind of like a garbage heap of a lot of stuff in American culture. We know that there's going to be all kinds of weird stuff growing that's going to become pretty exciting and pretty different. So I see big
and part
I just to end it, I see big changes coming, but I don't think, as in the 70s, which, Matt, you and I talk a lot about the 70s and the Declaration of Independence, it's widely misunderstood as that the 70s were this awful, awful period. In fact, it was an incredibly fertile period that gave rise to all of the stuff that is dying now. And I think in the rotting of this garbage, the rotting of this corpse, you know, there's going to be a lot of magic mushrooms.
And just, you know, Blondie is an artifact of that. Blondie arrived in 1970s New York, which was an absolute dump of a place. All right, let's shift topics one last time, kind of a lightning round before we get to our end of show business, which is that this week, allegedly, will feature the selection by Democratic presidential nominee Joseph Biden of his vice presidential lady candidate. Catherine, you're a lady. Are you excited about who are you excited more about? Kamala Harris, Susan Rice, Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, apparently, or Tammy Duckworth, the Illinois senator? Or are you just excited that finally your gender is being honored?
Yes.
Finally, we'll get on a presidential ticket, yeah. Right? Because no woman has been on a presidential ticket since Geraldine Ferraro.
That's right. That's how I recall it as well. As always, I commend to our podcast audience one of Reason TV's greatest hits of all time, which was back when it looked like Hillary was going to be president, and we made an inspirational rapid cut celebrity testimonial type video celebrating the potential advent of a woman in the White House. I urge you to check it out. We will link it in the write-up to this podcast because it makes the point.
Says you.
That it does not matter whether or not it's a lady if that lady is also a garbage tyrant. And it seems to me, based on our current list,
that is so sexist.
Potential candidates that is a likely outcome. Now, I obviously, from a purely journalistic perspective, would be excited to spend more time digging into the record of Kamala Harris, since we already have a sort of expertise there, thanks to the incredible work of Elizabeth Nolan Brown and others in digging out her record as a law and order prosecutor who should be not popular right now, who should be the opposite of what the Democratic Party is looking for if they want to speak to the present controversies about abuse of law enforcement, policing, and incarceration. So I do think that that movement has taken a dent out of what would have otherwise been something more of a cakewalk for her in terms of her vice presidential chances, although she and Biden certainly have had plenty of conflict as well. But she to me has the most, I know the most about her record, and I hate almost all of it. And I also think she's basically the front runner, unless things have changed dramatically in the 2 weeks that I was again anesthetized by a small baby.
Nick, I am and continue to be struck by the prominence in the pecking order of Susan Rice. In particular, are you excited about the prospect of reliving Benghazi?
I'm over the moon, Matt. I'm over the moon because we never really got to what happened at Benghazi.
But
spending the next 30 years talking about Benghazi is, you know, part of me never left that.
But
man.
What is it?
Susan Rice is not going to be, she's not going to be the nominee because the Democrats, bless their pointed little heads, have a pretty good track record of not bringing in novelty candidates for this kind of stuff. That's really a Republican thing. You know, recently departed pizza magnate and cereal thigh squeezer Herman Cain is like a classic case of a Republican, Republicans fall for these, you know, kind of stunt characters and candidates like Donald Trump, like Ben Carson, people who have no experience and not even any, you know, obvious interest in running for things. Susan Rice has never been elected to anything. Susan Rice has a terrible reputation, even within a good chunk of the Democratic Party, much less the populace. It's not going to be Susan Rice. It'll be somebody who is a sitting member of Congress or the Senate or something like that, or has a past history or a governor or something. What is fascinating to me about this is that I was looking, I think it was a Rasmussen poll, where, you know, something like 60% of people don't expect Joe Biden, if he's the president, to last through one term, but only like 30% said that, you know, that who he picks as vice president even matters to them. So it's like, I mean, we are so deep into nihilism on some level, it's kind of wonderful. But it goes to the point that, like, the vice president is noise around zero. It doesn't really matter. It'll be a story for a couple of weeks, even in this case where Joe Biden, despite having successfully ridden a bicycle on Fox News and looking pretty good doing it over the weekend, it doesn't matter. It's going to be between him and Trump. And that's going to be enough of a shit show to keep us gassed up through the election.
Peter, are there any people on the even expanded short list of potential VP picks who have a flicker of interest from a libertarian point of view, as far as you can tell?
Not really. I would say, though, that following Catherine's point about Kamala Harris, that Harris is arguably the worst, and I also think would be the worst for Biden's campaign. One of the reasons that Biden is doing pretty well right now is that he's barely running a campaign. He's just hanging out in his basement, going for an occasional bike ride, giving a speech every now and then that nobody really pays that much attention to, and it's working because it lets Donald Trump and hang himself on the noose of the coronavirus, right? And Kamala Harris is an attention seeker, is someone who she proved in her campaign last year when she was running for the Democratic nomination that she is not a great candidate. She just can't help but step in it all the time because she loves media attention. And also doesn't really think through what she's saying or through the long-term implications of it. This was particularly evident in her immediate and disastrous embrace of Medicare for All and eliminating all insurance for everyone, just kind of blasé, you know, casually saying, sure, let's get rid of everybody's private insurance. Nobody likes it anyway. And it was this huge deal. And then she had to walk it back, and then she had to walk it forward again, and she sort of flip-flopped and changed her mind a whole bunch of times.
It sounds like an amazing actually, dance that you just choreographed.
It's like a TikTok
dance. Right. She was doing an amazing TikTok dance about Medicare for All, and it was a fun show to watch, but it was pretty clear she hadn't actually thought through the policy and political ramifications of what she was saying in advance and just wanted to say something that was going to get her attention in the moment. She's very good at that, but that sort of thing is going to distract from Donald Trump and all the stuff that and the focus that Biden's campaign wants to keep on Donald Trump and that has successfully kept Biden in the lead so far.
Well, one of the kind of clouds surrounding Biden's candidacy, and as long as you focus on Trump, you know, which is a smart move, like you don't see it or anything, is the enthusiasm gap. And it might be interesting to think about, is somebody like Kamala Harris going to generate more interest among African Americans who didn't come out for Hillary Clinton and who Joe Biden has presumed will come out for him, but he also needs to button up that voting demographic, you know, in a way that Susan Rice, I don't think, will generate that. Elizabeth Warren might get the Bernie bros out, but she is, you know, painfully white. I mean, she is like translucent when it comes to that. And she has an agenda which is, I think, more disastrous than Kamala Harris's ultimately, because it has, you know, she agrees in broad form with a lot of regulatory controls that a bunch of Republican conservatives are actually yapping about. But I think that's part of the calculation in Biden is like, is there somebody there who is going to lock down or actually jazz up an existing part of the Democratic electorate that he, you know, he really needs every vote.
I just don't think it's going to be Warren, even though she has been rumored she's been on some of the short lists. The way Joe Biden is going to reach out to the Warren Bernie wing of his party is through his policy agenda. And his policy agenda, even like from the moment that it was pretty clear he was going to win, but he hadn't gotten there yet, has been shifting leftward and leftward and leftward on economic policy issues, not all the way to the full Bernie platform, but much further than even Joe Biden was in January. And that is going to be his outreach, is through policy. And then he's going to do stuff like, I mean, I very much think that Joe Biden, if he has a Democratic Senate with 51 votes, is going to get rid of the filibuster, and they are going to pass, again, not the full Bernie package, but let's say, you know, Bernie Light is just going to run through the Democratic Congress in the first 2 years if we end up with a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic House, as seems at least possible at this point.
And if we do end up with divided government, I think, you know, I said earlier I wasn't really fully in the mood for retroactive whataboutism with respect to executive orders, but I am very comfortable doing forward-looking whataboutism with respect to executive orders. I mean, that list of people that we have just gone through, Elizabeth Warren is what kind of triggered me on this here, but like they all said during the primary campaign that they would use executive orders to accomplish their policy agendas if they encountered even the slightest opposition from Congress. And we have every reason to take them at their words. This is not a one-off Trump has broken the norms thing. Like, Trump has broken the norms, but he is setting new norms in doing that. And all of these Democrats will absolutely use the pen and the phone to accomplish their agendas if they possibly can, and if they encounter congressional opposition.
The pen and the jitterbug phone.
Yeah, Trump is giving
it's the quill and the jitterbug.
Trump is giving the next Democratic president permission to do as much as he or she wants by executive order.
So can I ask you guys, have you had these conversations with people? And this has come, I try never to talk about politics, even on the job, but much less off the job. And it is becoming increasingly, as I think Peter was suggesting, it's becoming increasingly hard to know what, you know, it's just kind of like you're alive 24 hours a day, and some of it's work, some of it's not. It's increasingly difficult to make any distinctions whatsoever. But a bunch of people have been saying, you know, like Biden is likely to be captured literally or figuratively by the hard left of the Democratic Party, and that they are talking about voting for Trump, or at least wanting Trump to stay in office, because the presumption is the Democrats take the House and the Senate. And if they are given a clear, you know, if they take the White House as well, then we are like way over on the left, far beyond whatever Hillary Clinton was talking about 4 years ago. And I've been hearing people who I wouldn't have ever guessed have any, you know, interest in somebody like Trump, but kind of wanting to see him get a second term. Have you guys encountered that?
Yes.
At all?
I mean, I would just say that the one way to think about this is look at the current dispute in Congress over the next round of coronavirus aid and the House package. Their opening bid was an additional $3 trillion. If there was a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president, there is no question that something along those lines, maybe not that exact package, but something very close, would have gone through already, and probably in a few months, we'd get another one. And that is the sort of thing that we could and should expect just constantly in the first 2 years of a Democratic presidency in which Democrats also control the House and the Senate.
To answer your question, no, I haven't had conversations like that, but I don't spend a lot of time talking about politics with humans, so maybe I'm living
present
in a,
company accepted from humanity
bubble no, you, of apolitics, perhaps.
What do you do for baseball, Matt Welch? It's August.
And
you are a junkie.
No, I'm not. I mean, I haven't been this cut off from sports since I lived in a place when I couldn't access it, and the internet didn't exist. I'll throw it on a little bit at the end of the night when I remember, and I'll just have it with a sound off on my phone. But I'm not really paying much attention and not particularly excited about any of it. It's all very strange and disquieting. Speaking of which, let's go to our end of show. What the hell you've been consuming culturally? I'm going to go first just to give Nick ample opportunity to make fun of me. I presume that he will actually know somehow of this thing that I had no idea about until I started, as I'd mentioned, I think last week, marching through the month by month music releases of 1989 and soliciting help. Excuse me, from people on Twitter to help me make these sort of Spotify playlists of noteworthy kind of best of or just funny musics that come from there. And so one thing that people on Twitter pointed me towards that came out in May of 1989 is actually an album that was recorded in 1976 by a Chicago prog rock, P-R-O-G, rock outfit, jazz noodle nightmare thing called Yezda Urfa. They had a record called Sacred Baboon. Why not? And it's great. It's great. I don't like prog rock, but it's like super fast and all these time signature craziness. The guy's vocals sound a bit like Yes back in the day. And if you're going to listen to one song off of their Sacred Baboon record. So these guys like self-financed a record. They thought they're going to make it big. We're going to release it, but they spent all their money doing it. And they're like, we're going to lose money if we release it. So let's just sit on it. And they disbanded. And then someone found it in the 80s and they released it. It became this sort of cult classic, crazy old record, Yezda Urfa, Sacred Baboon. There's some song having to do with, like, you know, how to eat the rawhide chewies or the ridiculous name like that. That's a pretty good entry into it. So check it out. Yezda Urfa, Sacred Baboon. I'm not even kidding. Catherine, do you want to go next?
Sure. In my continuing spirit of consuming apocalypses slightly different than our own, I finally got around to watching Snowpiercer, which was a great pandemic film. What if humanity was stuck on a high-speed train going through a frozen landscape of nothingness? Feels relevant. That's a Suderman recommendation to me, possibly even a past Suderman recommendation on this podcast, but I make it again to you now. I combined that with, again, holding a small baby, which, spoiler for those who have not seen it, you want to probably mute for a second here or turn off, but some of the plot revolves around eating babies. So that was not optimal, but, you know, you got to face the hard truths. And I alternated it with the Taylor Swift album. So it was all around a great choice, and I recommend both Snowpiercer itself and that pairing for people who just want to have their head be somewhere else.
What, eating babies? Yes. While watching Snowpiercer?
Light snacking.
Just a nibble. A nibble.
If you're into if you're
it really makes you rethink the snack car, the cafe car.
You know what?
On
it doesn't though, because I already had the absolute worst thoughts and feelings about the Acela cafe car. So honestly, like, baby eating would be better than what I expect is occurring there.
You have been hitting up that cheeseburger, that microwave cheeseburger.
I've smelled it.
That's how you do it.
In the whole train.
Suderman, what kind of microwave cheeseburgers have you been consuming of the mind?
If for folks who have seen Snowpiercer, I strongly recommend looking into how that movie was shot. And so they actually built four train cars on a series of gimbals so that the cars would move accurately during filming, right? And kind of shift back and forth. And so it's not like a green screen with all the stuff animated in the background. I mean, there is, of course, the exterior is all green screened, but between cars, like, the cars are actually moving and in time.
So they managed to do more than the state of California has done in like 20 years.
Yes, they actually built high-speed rail.
After they finished filming, they just donated the successfully built rail to whatever state they were in.
But now it's just sitting like in some rail yard somewhere. I have been watching HBO's revived Perry Mason, an 8-episode series. The first season is 8 episodes. There's going to be a second season. It is a reboot of the kind of classic legal show. This time, and this time it's much grittier, sort of much darker, but it's really exquisitely produced. At first, I think it's sort of not clear what this show is going to be about, except that it's going to be another really nice looking HBO kind of period mystery. But as you get further into the show, what you see is that it's a legal show about the ways that the criminal justice system has historically not produced justice, especially for women and for minorities, and in particular the ways that the state uses the legal system. Or the actors within the state use the legal system to pursue their own selfish ends and their own power. And so, you know, this is a show in which the cops are the bad guys and the DA is just somebody who's out to convict someone who he doesn't care if that person has actually done what that person has been accused of doing. What he wants is something he can run on when he is going to run for mayor. And so, you know, the legal system isn't really about truth or fairness. It doesn't care who it hurts in the process of giving those people power. Several of the folks involved in this were also involved with Boardwalk Empire, another great HBO kind of period drama. There's a lot in common just sort of stylistically, but also thematically, because Boardwalk Empire was a show about how prohibition empowered bad people on both sides of the law. It's almost an anti-legal thriller, right? In the sense that it is not a show about how the criminal justice system produces justice. It's a show about how the state doesn't, and about how a private detective who becomes a defense lawyer is actually the person who is protecting the rights of the innocent.
I just wanted to point out that if you're going to see a train that can't stop movie, always recommend Runaway Train, the great John Voight, yeah. Eric Roberts vehicle, Akira Kurosawa.
Oh, and please, you're forgetting Rebecca De Mornay.
I can't.
As the mechanic, as the kind of gender fluid mechanic,
Manny,
in that movie.
I'm cold.
Not Tony Scott's Unstoppable with Chris Pine and... Denzel Washington?
No, not. Nick.
Unstoppable is kind of a poor man's Runaway Train, which I believe John Voight was nominated for an Academy
Deserved
Award.
Incredible. Yeah. Nick, tell us what you have been consuming besides Gerald Ford porn over the weekend.
Jerry Ford is just he's the best. He's the last good goddamn president we had. I have been reading, I read Greg Gutfeld's new book, The Plus, Self-Help for People Who Hate Self-Help, and the irascible Fox News host, former Red Eye inventor, founder, creator, Greg Gutfeld show host, as well as a co-host of The Five, has a actually fantastic book out about self-help where he lays out his shtick. His gimmick is being, you can either be a plus or a minus. And he makes the case, surprisingly, for being a plus rather than a minus. Yeah. No, stunning. I mean, you don't see it coming until the last couple of pages, but it's a very good book, and it's actually, it's uplifting and upbeat, and it's a small green shoot about, you know, at some point, and we have to make it end, but at some point, this is going to end. You know, the deadlock of, you know, if let's pretend that Trump and Biden are Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty, they're about to go over Reichenbach Falls. American culture, we are at such a dead end where the runaway train that is finally slowing out of steam somewhere down in Tierra del Fuego, we're going to get off and we're going to start something new. The Plus is actually a nice, is a nice kind of emanation of that anticipation.
You'd say that train is unstoppable.
Runaway train.
I would like to, but I feel like I'm committed to not saying it's unstoppable. It's going to fall off of Reichenbach.
You heard it here first. Nick Gillespie is going to strive to become a net plus in his life and in society.
Is it net plus or is it gross that we're aiming for here?
I think.
Yeah, you know what? He doesn't really go into, he doesn't tally things right up in the end. Okay. So, you know, it's like you can either be a plus or a minus.
It's plus and minus and this is the binary we're working in, then it's like a battery and there's, you know, you've got both sides, right?
Oh, you need both to connect,
to my
complete
son, in that
the
case,
current.
We're going
to
need
right?
five lemons and a bunch of alligator cliffs because that is the experiment of the pandemic.
Okay,
for us.
I look forward to a new version of The Giving Tree, maybe, by Greg Gutfeld coming up.
I'm glad your son is planning something.
Someone, somewhere.
Thank you for listening. Keep going to Reason.com podcast. Listen to the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Other stuff, Soho Forum, etc. And we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.
I missed you guys.
Oh.